Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are 6 days out from Election Day, although every day is Election Day during this cycle. So joining us to talk about all of this with less than a week to go is our colleague, Bill Kristol. Bill, thanks for coming on the podcast again.
Good to be with you, Charlie. I can't believe it's 6 days. When did you start? I remember we talked and you started the countdown on your newsletter. Well, that was like it's 70 days or 60 days.
It was around then. It seemed like a long time to go.
It's like, I know, but it seems like it was 3 years ago, right?
Everything. You know how old I am? I remember when we were all tweeting about Jeffrey Toobin and his Zoom meeting. I mean, that's the weird thing about our time cycle. Okay, so I want to start off with karma. My newsletter headline today is Trump's karmic fiasco, and basically, I think with a week to go here, you know, Trump's campaign has become this karmic fiasco because, you know, the pandemic that he ignored and downplayed is returning to destroy his presidency. And you had a really remarkable moment, I thought, in my home state of Wisconsin yesterday. He has another one of his rallies in western Wisconsin, and let's just play this soundbite.
And you know, with the fake news, everything is COVID. COVID, COVID, COVID. I had it. Here I am, right? I had it. First Lady had it. Barron had it, but Barron had it for about 12 seconds. Young, that immune system, young. No, it's COVID. You turn on the news. COVID, COVID. You know when they're going to stop talking about it so much? November 4th. You're right. November 4th. Oh, it's a whole crazy thing. I mean, it's too complicated to explain. These people are very corrupt, very dishonest, but they got a lot of problems. On November 4th, you'll hear we're doing extremely well. And you'll see. You know, they used to always say that Europe.
So, Bill, this is breathtaking. Because here in Wisconsin, yesterday was the day we were hammered. We hit record numbers. I mean, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel headline, it's a nightmare scenario. Wisconsin reports more than 5,200 cases in one day, 64 deaths. This is no longer a slow motion disaster. This is a disaster in warp speed. And here is the president mocking the severity of COVID on the day in which every news broadcast, every newspaper, every headline is about, hey, this is Wisconsin's moment. We are, you know, this is deadly. In terms of tone deafness, it's almost off the scale.
I mean, I do wonder whether the actual rallies are now hurting Trump, and that is marginally, obviously. His fans like seeing him on the road, I suppose. Maybe that helps a few of them turn out, and people like me don't think you should be doing this and find it offensive, as you just said, not only tone deaf, but as you said, offensive and really almost disgusting.
Dangerous. I
mean, people are dying. There's a real surge. I've talked privately, just as it happens, to a couple of public health professionals in the last week or so for various sort of random reasons. But I mean, I would say they're, what they say privately is consistent with what they say publicly. They're not dishonest people, but they're a little more alarmed, I would say, than they feel like in public they need to be, you know, measured and so forth. But I mean, going into the winter with a never having really suppressed it, unlike in Europe where they're getting a surge, but it's bad actually, but it's from very low levels. So, and Europe is also locking down selectively cities and counties and states, the equivalent, and for 2-3 weeks to kind of get it back under control. We're, of course, not really doing that or doing it in a very haphazard way. So they think we're going to have a bad winter. I mean, it is a lie. I just want to say it is false that things are going to be better on November 4th or on December 4th. It's just false. And for Trump to say it and therefore encourage people to be, you know, negligent about wearing masks and not serious about not taking the thing seriously is just terrible. I mean, it makes it hard for school systems to plan responsibly because you do want things to reopen to the degree they can, but they can only do that with testing. And then we get back into the whole thing, the incredible failures of policy. But this level of sort of cavalier negligence, really almost criminal negligence, I would say, about the pandemic is terrible. I do think that people, especially in a state like Wisconsin, I'm curious whether how much, you know, it's interesting. There was a poll this morning that no one believes, the ABC Washington Post poll.
Yeah, 17 points.
17 points, Trump deficit. But I do wonder if in a state like Wisconsin, which is getting hit harder than some of the other states, It wouldn't surprise me that much if the number against Trump opened up a little bit here in the last week or two, more than in a Michigan or Pennsylvania. Texas, which is pretty clearly pretty close and in play, is having a terrible surge. El Paso is talking about having to medevac patients. You know, elsewhere was the hospital, ICUs are full. Anyway, I don't know what it feels like. I mean, is it really penetrating on the, you know, to people there that this thing is really bad?
I think it is. And of course, it, you know, it doesn't affect the Trump hardcore base, but that base is not big enough in Wisconsin. And I want to talk about that in just a second. No, there's no question about it that the thing that's driving the story in Wisconsin right now is the pandemic. And I think the same thing's happening in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. So you raise the possibility whether or not these rallies are actually hurting him. And I think that's something to keep an eye on, you know, in terms of the karma, because those were kind of his magic sauce 4 years ago, right? This is his comfort zone to hold these rallies. And yet everywhere he goes now, instead of getting positive publicity, he gets negative publicity because of the fiasco that it's causing, including what happened in Omaha last night, where they stranded all of these people out in the cold without buses. I mean, these things are, it's like the magic dust has gone, but I do think that they are backfiring. So it is kind of interesting watching people go, well, why is Joe Biden not out there holding, you know, rallies and campaigning harder? Actually, by just letting Donald Trump have a stage to himself right now may be the best political strategy. You know what I mean? I mean, every time Donald Trump goes out there, it's like, as long as the focus is on Trump and this election is a referendum on Trump, that's a good scenario for Joe Biden.
The Trump campaign retweeted two photos, I think I saw this morning. One is of Trump speaking to a packed rally, and the other is of Biden speaking to socially distanced people. I mean, it's a few dozen people, it looks like, somewhere. I'm not even sure what state it was in. You know, and giving them, obviously not doing a packed rally. And the Trump people think that's just an incredible indictment, I suppose, or Biden. They ridicule him. They literally ridicule. Think about it for a minute. It's obviously not like the Democratic Party in these states couldn't get a few thousand people, you know, to come someplace. But they have many, many times. They think it's an indictment of Biden that he's being cautious and careful and respectful of his voters by not actually telling them to come mix and mingle. And there is some empirical evidence. It's not that, you know, we don't know how much any particular rally is a super spreader. That depends on the accident of who's there and what happens there. But there is some evidence that these rallies are not helping, certainly. So anyway, it is. I do think it's sort of a lot. Trump sort of has the right instinct, which is he sort of understands COVID has been his handling of it has been so damaging to him that he wants to dismiss it. And I guess maybe if you're sort of already on board, you kind of lap that up. I think maybe you do lap that when he says COVID, 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 that's all they want to talk about. Well, people are tired of it. People would like to get beyond it. Sure. If you want to engage in wishful thinking and want to believe Trump, you'll believe that it will be over November 4th. I'm a little spooked by the number of people I personally have, and I'd say me and close family members have run into, and these are not really friends, but, you know, people that ran into in this grocery store and stuff, and so far as one goes to those anymore, you know, casually. And if you're inclined to be for Trump, you're also inclined to tell yourself exactly what Trump said yesterday, that it's going to be, going to be over, so to speak. This is being wildly exaggerated. It's going to be over on November 4th. And that's where the damage is done, is that's going to affect people's behavior.
It is. So it will get worse. And that's where I think when you listen to him, you realize, okay, he's not going to take the steps that is going to prevent this.
He's president of the United States from November 4th to January 20th. And I'm pretty alarmed thinking about that interregnum. I mean, how much irresponsibility will we have? How much failure to come to grips with the pandemic that could be getting worse and worse? And, you know, what's he going to be doing? And as a little, the rest of the government could try to do things, but as we've seen, it's hard to do it if the president doesn't want to sign off on it or coordinate the effort.
So you mentioned the ABC Washington Post poll, which shows him up. Shows Biden up by 17 points in Wisconsin, which I think most people, at least for now, think of as an outlier. Also shows him with Biden with a comfortable lead in Michigan. Oh, they called it to 6-7 point lead, which they call slim, which I suppose is slim in comparison to 17 points. We're going to get a better picture of Wisconsin later today. Probably by the time people are listening to this podcast, we will have gotten the results of the Marquette University Law Poll, which is considered the most credible poll here in Wisconsin. And that poll has shown no movement whatsoever. It's been 4 points, 4 points, 5 points, 5 points. I mean, no tightening, no broadening, nothing. So if it's anything different than, say, 5 points, it's an indication of, you know, some dramatic move. But I think I just want to throw out one factoid about Wisconsin that I'm slightly obsessed with. And I know that Tim Alberta mentions it in Politico magazine as well. You know, Trump won Wisconsin 4 years ago, but he got fewer votes than Mitt Romney got 4 years earlier. Mitt Romney lost Wisconsin by 7 percentage points in 2012, but he got more votes than Donald Trump got in 2016. So what happened in 2016 was an abnormally low turnout by Wisconsin standards. It was about 2.8 million. Based on the early voting and the absentee ballots that are coming in, I think it's possible that we're going to see something like 3.3 million votes. That's a half million more votes this time than last time. And I think that a lot of those are going to be Democratic votes. And generally, the pattern has been in the past that big turnout elections like that favor Democrats in Wisconsin. The lower turnout elections, the off-year elections, tend to favor Republicans. So that's one of the dynamics. How does it change the outcome when the electorate expands that dramatically?
If your numbers are you know, kind of your guesstimate is right, that's about a 20% increase in turnout.
It's huge.
In 2016. Nationally, it looks like people, you know, this is an imprecise science at least, but I think the overall national turnout was 139 million something presidential vote in 2016. It looks like we may go above 150. I kind of wonder if we'll get close to 160, but
yeah,
you know, I think 153 or 4 would be a 10% increase in turnout. But I tend to agree. There could be some Trump voters, of course, turning out in that number. There will be some. But I've got to think that that higher turnout tilts towards Biden. And there's some evidence that that the turnout has increased among younger people, which is interesting. I was talking to a Democrat about 6 months ago, an operative, you know, pretty savvy type, kind of very worried. This is after the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And they've counted a lot on turning out on human-to-human canvassing, both in inner cities where people, you know, aren't wealthy. They don't have necessarily all the phones and that, checking their text messages all the time. And they really have turned out, especially in the African-American community, people get turned out neighbor to neighbor, churches on Sunday, come door to door. They figured they couldn't do that, and they haven't done much of that in the pandemic. And then on college campuses at the University of Wisconsin, let's say, a huge liberal vote there, and a Democratic vote in Madison, obviously. You know, you've seen it. They set up a million tables and they register everyone, and they, you know, they it's very easy, pretty easy if everyone's in one place, to get them to vote. And they were very worried that these people will be dispersed doing virtual learning, and much harder to get to them. Now, it seems like they've done a good job, I've got to say, on, you know, texting and emailing and phone calling and, you know, compensating for the pandemic. I think that's one of the underreported stories. If it turns out to be a pretty good year for the Democrats and for Biden, they seem to have adjusted pretty well to the pandemic when they were worried, because they thought, look, the Trump people are going to vote. And the Trump people, you know, you're 68-year-old in Western Wisconsin or Northern Wisconsin, you drive to the polls, you vote. It's, you know, if there's a pandemic, you wear a mask, but hopefully, but, you know, you're not dependent on as much as a 23-year-old in Madison or a 28-year-old in Milwaukee in sort of having someone remind you to vote, help you to vote, maybe drive you to the polls even, and tell you, you know, make sure you fill out the form correctly if you're filling out an absentee. But it seems like the Democrats have done a pretty good job on the ground. It's hard to know right now, but
it is hard to know because there is no ground game. But I will tell you this, and this is a random anecdote. This is not data. This is not anything. But I get every day. I get multiple these sort of blast text messages, you know, threatening me from the Republicans, like, you must vote. You know, don't you want to keep America great again? You know, turn in your ballot. Look, I've already voted. I've already turned in my ballot. But these blasts come out. Last night, while I was trying to disconnect, I get a text saying, hi, this is Dan. I'm a volunteer here in Wisconsin, and I want to let you know what your options are for early voting. Is this Charles? And I wrote back and I said, seriously? You know, I mean, you know, it's like, are you a real person talking to me as a real person? Is there a kid that, I mean, really? Is there a Dan? Are you really Dan? Are you really writing to me? And it turned out the answer is yes, that there was some guy in northern Wisconsin who was texting individual people, which I thought was, I don't know whether that's the most efficient way of doing it, but it was striking. So, Bill, you
have a friend of mine in Florida, similarly, he had re-registered as a Democrat to vote in the primary. He's a Republican for Biden. So that was, you know, in the Florida primary in March. And now he's, so it's a he's registered as a Democrat. He's voted early already, but he's been struck by how many texts and emails he's gotten from, you know, the Florida Democratic Party. And also similarly, some of them random and, you know, obviously just mass emails. But he said one or two actual, he got back, you know, he responded to a couple and it was similar that there were actual humans at the other end who had been pretty well trained in how to have a conversation. So it didn't matter in his case, but with an undecided voter. So that maybe that's, maybe they've done a good job.
It, well, also some other weird things, and this may seem kind of random here, but I can't remember a time when the Democrats had such a huge advantage in terms of money. Yeah. And you really feel that. You feel it in your mailbox. You see it on television, the radio ads. And it is interesting how much money is being put into state legislative races here. There's no chance for Democrats to flip the legislature. I mean, the gerrymandering is so intense, they're not even going to come close. But there are reports that they are dumping, and again, people need to understand that Wisconsin assembly races are much, much, much lower profile than maybe in some other places, but they're targeting the sitting speaker of the state assembly. And the most recent report is they're prepared to dump, Democratic groups are prepared to dump $800,000 into this race.
Well, I would say it's crazy. I asked someone who's a political pro, you know, what is the disparity of spending matter? I mean, just generally, my experience has been, if you're losing, you're losing. You can outspend people all you want. People don't want to vote for you. They don't want to vote for you and vice versa. But he made a good point. He said, look, if you're ahead 5-6 points and you can outspend your opponent 3-1, it's not that you're going to convert, necessarily go up to 7, 8, 9 points, but you probably, if there's a little natural erosion happening, you can probably halt it or slow it. So you go from 6-5 instead of 6-3, you know, which I think is a good way of thinking about it. If you're sort of inclined to be for Biden, sort of doubtful about Trump, and you get just pretty good ads, you know, day after day on TV and some digital stuff, it probably makes you more inclined to stay where you are rather than switch back. So I think that is probably helping the Democrats some.
So here's an analogy that I was playing with, may not be good. Looking at some of these really, really close polls in some of the swing states, and I'm thinking of Georgia right now, where it's a, to use the cliche, it's a jump ball in some of these states. So let's just assume that it's tied in all of these states, and it's a jump ball. Which way is the wind blowing right now? I was doing a radio show earlier this morning, and I was listening to the broadcast, and every single story was about the coronavirus, the stock market falling, the lack of any sort of stimulus aid. We're not talking about Bobulinski or anything like that. So if you're Trump, you know, all of the dynamics of the race seem to be blowing against you in the final days of the campaign. Really the opposite of 2016. Remember, everything broke for Trump in the final weeks of the campaign. We may not have realized it at the time, but in retrospect, this feels completely different, especially you and I are talking right now, with the Dow Jones is down 600 points, you know, every front page of every newspaper in the country is about the surge of the coronavirus. His last minute October surprise has completely fizzled and he's out of money.
I think the only thing cutting against that, I would say the main thing, but is a little bit normally for an incumbent. If you look at some of these races, like when we were down in 92, the George H.W. Bush campaign, another era, obviously, mm-hmm. We were down maybe 7, 8, 9, and we closed it to ended up 5.5. I mean, there's a little bit of a devil you know and better than the devil you know.
Coming home,
so to speak. So, but again, that's usually a point or two. That's not 5 points or 8 points, you know.
Okay, so you had a piece in the Bulwark yesterday, the three possible outcomes. And I love this because you point out historically in the last century, three presidents have lost re-election bids for a second term. We realize that only three. Herbert Hoover, 32, Jimmy Carter, 1980, George H.W. Bush in 92. And they all had a little different feel, but, you know, distinctive after effects. So let's go through all of this, because you say, you know, it seems likely that Trump is going to follow these, you know, one term president's footsteps. So you sort of historically go back and look at the dynamics. So let's do it the way you did it in the article, going in backwards order. 1992, retirement. As you point out, George H.W. Bush lost by 5.6 percentage points to Clinton. It was a defeat. It wasn't a rout, but it was a defeat.
Yeah, it sure was. I mean, so the broader point here is that, you know, by a little better than 2-1, Americans tend to reelect presidents when they've elected once. I put aside the sort of appointed presidents, the Fords, and then the president who stepped down, like Johnson. So you could complicate this, but basically that's correct. And of course, the last three elections, presidents have won reelection, Clinton, Bush, and Obama. So the notion that Trump, if he loses, it's a little bit unusual, and there are only three of them in the last century. And they do tend to signify a change in our politics, because, again, the default is kind of keep the guy there if he's doing an adequate job. 92, we lost. Republicans, the Senate stayed the same in overall numbers. And I think Republicans picked up a few House seats because of reapportionment.
Which I'd forgotten, by the way.
Yeah, and that was a kind of actually year. I mean, but there were all those pro voters who voted Republican down ballot. So it's a little more complicated if you get into the news. But basically, I mean, people were tired, 12 years of Reagan Bush, the Cold War had ended, that was a big deal, and people thought, okay, let's get a young guy in there who can focus more on education and healthcare and so forth. Clinton was a moderate Democrat. But at the end of the day, it was an important election in some ways, but it didn't, it wasn't a repudiation of everything Reagan had done. It didn't set the Democrats off into permanent majority status. They probably lost Congress for the first time in 40 years, 2 years later. We then had very competitive races, obviously, for the next 20 years, really, in a lot of cases. But or till today. But so it was an important election in that it was, you could say it began a certain era, but it wasn't, you know, a realigning election, a transformative election, an ideologically hugely significant election. That's kind of if you lose. And so my analogy would be if Trump loses by 5 or 6 points, if Republicans hold the Senate, I think the Senate here is now that becomes more important. It will not mean a repudiation, a full repudiation of Trump, and certainly not of Trumpism. It'll just be he lost in a re-election because of COVID and the recession, I suppose. But, you know, plenty of people will say, but the message was basically right. A better messenger with the same message and better circumstances 4 years from now could do fine. I think the amount of rethinking is kind of limited if you lose that kind of race.
Well, and as you point out, you know, that not only was it not a down ballot route, but Republicans 2 years later took over both houses of Congress in 1994 and held them for the rest of the decade. So, you know, it was obviously not a terrible.
Right. So they retired. Early retired George H.W. Bush. That was unfortunate for some of us at the time, but it's very different from a kind of real, okay, sort of go in a different direction.
Pretty gentle reelection defeat.
Yes.
Okay. So 1980, rejection.
So Carter loses by almost 10 points. They lose 12 Senate seats. Republicans win the Senate for the first time in a quarter century. And Reagan, obviously, a pretty stark ideological difference from Carter, and you know, leads to the Reagan Revolution, as it's called, and big changes in domestic policy, or tax policy at least, and in foreign policy, and all kinds of consequences. And of course, Reagan wins in 84, and then Bush wins in 88. So a kind of more significant inflection point, more significant fork in the road for American politics. I'd say the analogy for this year would be if Trump lost by 8, let's say, or 10, like Reagan, you know, Reagan 8-9, and if Republicans lose the Senate, you could imagine Democrats being in pretty good shape for a little while, A, and B, Republicans doing more rethinking. I mean, Democrats didn't do as much rethinking as one would have thought they would have done in the early mid-80s. They finally got around to it with Clinton. But I do think if they lose the Senate, the chance of at least some less Trumpy Republicans being more prominent in the next 2-4 years is much higher. The sense of, you know, gee, we're just going to keep losing unless we do things differently. So I think that's the kind of, that's the sort of middle case. And right now, probably the case that's most consistent with most of the polls.
Yeah, as you point out, it was not in the grand scheme of things either a realigning election or a transformative one. Its after effects, which were significant, were measured in decades rather than generations. Which I thought was an interesting point, because I do, you know, I think we're used to thinking of 1980s being kind of transformational, but not compared to 1932. So 1992 is retirement, 1980 is rejection, 1932 was epic. This was the repudiation. Herbert Hoover loses to FDR by 17.7%. Wow.
And, you know, after Republicans had won three elections in a row, obviously in the 20s, yeah. And they lose, I don't know, a dozen Senate seats, 97 House seats, kind of a different era then, where the national swings were more pronounced and et cetera. But so that's kind of amazing. And obviously we get the New Deal, we get a million things that happen in the next decade, in the next three, four, or five decades. But basically the New Deal era lasts, you know, through the Great Society. You
really, yeah.
Like, I mean, think of it this way. Eisenhower, who's a huge war hero, is the only Republican to win the presidency between 1928 and 1968. I mean, so, you know, it's a Democratic era. The Republicans even it up in Congress, some in the 50s and stuff, but still we get the New Deal and then the Great Society, civil rights, all kinds of things. A big, you know, every historian who writes about American political history has the 32 electors, one of the three or four biggest. So now that really would, I think that would require that Wisconsin poll this morning be not totally an outlier, that we get to a 11 or 12 point maybe Trump defeat, which wouldn't be, you know, totally out of the question. There are some partial polls that are 10 or 11 now. It would, I think, require that they lose more than the Senate by more than just a seat or two. For me, the big the sort of symbol of this would be Texas. I mean, I do feel that if the Republicans lost not just Florida, which I think they would do in the second scenario, the in between, you know, 1980 scenario, but in the if they lose Florida and Texas, I do think at that point every intelligent
Republican thinks,
well, what are we doing here? We've lost California, obviously. We'll always lose New York and Illinois. Now we're losing Florida and Texas. Like, do we have any states that are of any size that are going to ever be for us again? And the demographics going in the wrong direction. So I think, you know, that would be, now I don't know if it's not likely, it's possible, I would say, what the rejection would look like. And with Hoover, I went back and quickly skimmed the history, and I don't really know it that well. I don't know, it took the Republican Party a little while to move beyond Hoover, and then, of course, World War II happens. That's a little hard to kind of figure, you know, you can't be too wed to these analogies and historical examples. But at the end of the day, no one after 1936, certainly, or even in 36, proposed repealing the biggest parts of the New Deal. And it, so we were off on a different path, for better and worse, you know, as a country. So, and I kind of feel that, so that would be, I think, a case where you can imagine huge shakeups and debates in the Republican Party. Hard to know where the Democrats go with that size victory. It might encourage some of the more progressive Democrats, which wouldn't be great from my point of view. But so I think that just is more of a shakeup in our politics. And yes, and that's not just a repudiation of, oh, Donald Trump mishandled a couple of things or was foolish to keep on having rallies. That's really, I think that makes it harder for Trumpists to say, well, the idea was pretty good of Trump.
Right.
It just wasn't executed very well.
Right. And I think this is the point that we really are getting at, is what will it take to get rid of Trumpism? What will be the equivalent of an electoral exorcism? So there are the three you laid out very clearly, three alternative, you know, headlines. Number one, the minimal one, Trump loses presidency as Midwest flips, but the GOP holds the Senate. Probably not transformational. Or number two, Trump defeated by big margin, election called early as Florida and North Carolina go to Biden. Democrats win Senate. And then finally, the one you just laid out here, double digits popular vote route extends to victory in Texas. Democrats control Senate easily. Places like Georgia, you know, have flipped. And you just get a sense that, I mean, that's like this demographic freight train just rolling over the party. So, you know, yeah, each one of those would have different consequences. I think it's going to be very difficult to shake loose of Trumpism. It feels like the you know, after 4 years, I mean, I'll be honest with you, the transformation of the Republican Party and the conservative movement has been way worse in just 4 years than I was expecting. If it had been 8 years, I think it would have been utterly irrecoverable. But I think it's going to be really, really hard, given the way that the entire infrastructure of the conservative movement has bought into Donald Trump for them to make a pivot, even, I mean, barring the last case scenario, unless it's an absolute blowout, they'll find a way to rationalize. I mean, you're reading the same things I'm reading. It is fascinating to me, you know, watching some of the former, you know, never Trumpers, the anti-Trumpers, coming up with elaborate rationalizations, already beginning to pivot. None of the pivots are, wow, we made a terrible mistake with Donald Trump. You're not seeing it in National Review. You're not seeing it in the Washington Examiner. You're not hearing it from people like Ben Shapiro. They're all doubling down on it. So I'm not hearing the regrets and the confessions yet.
Yeah, no, I suppose the counter argument would be, you know, you never hear them ahead of time, and it sort of takes a while for things to sink in. But I tend to agree with you in the sense that, and look, if you think of my 1980 sort of middle, with pretty big repudiation, pretty big rejection analogy, the Democrats didn't rethink that much. It was sort of Tip O'Neill's party. They nominated Carter's vice president 4 years later, Gary Hart, I mean, who we now think of in other contexts, but, you know, was actually a serious politician who said, we got to rethink things. I'm a new Democrat. Challenged Mondale in 84 and, you know, ran a good campaign for a while, but ended up falling short. Then they nominated Dukakis in 88. It really took a decade for them to really rethink. And that's, of course, very different from Trump in the sense that that's just being stuck in a kind of conventional liberal mindset of the past. It wasn't that they were terrible people or that they were lying systematically to the American public or whatever. They were just, you know, Walter Mondale was just not the right person to defeat Ronald Reagan. Maybe you couldn't have done that anyway, of course. But so I tend to agree with you. I think, and I do think also, and this is something you saw very early and have written about, both the transformation of the conservative movement and the Republican Party and the degree to which those seeds were there before. I had a long talk with an economist reporter the other day, and I tried to emphasize to him that he needed to adopt your formulation of the recessive gene. give you credit for it too. It was recessive, which we shouldn't forget. I think people deserve some credit for keeping it recessive. We fought Pat Buchanan, we fought Ron Paul and so forth. But on the other hand, it was there and it really has flowered, I don't know, to mix metaphors here, burst forth in a very big way. And for me, that is the story. I mean, I've said it a few times, but I think it just, Trump, a demagogue can win a multi-candidate primary. We were surprised when it happened and disappointed. And you fought very hard against it in Wisconsin, which is one of the states he didn't win. But still, you know, it can happen, right? A demagogue can win a general election in a two-party system where the other candidate's unpopular and he gets some breaks in the last couple of weeks, as we were saying earlier with Jim Comey. But I would have said, I really, even with my, you know, disappointment and annoyance at the party and everyone accommodating in November, December of 2016, I think I still would have thought that, yeah, look, Republican elected officials who've been there before Trump, they're not going to simply go along with it.
Right.
Conservative elites, donors, intellectual elites, Wall Street Journal editorial page, National Review, which hosted the Never Trump Symposium, they're not going to simply justify and rationalize everything. There, I mean, that for me is the bigger story because it does therefore entrench Trumpism. I was trying to think, I don't know enough, you know, sort of European history and other parts of the world. I was trying to think, said to someone, you know, do the thought experiment. What if Trump, you know, they go along with some things they agree with, the judges, the taxes, but they call him out on other things. They rebuke him in certain ways. They chasten him. They don't just rubber stamp everything. What does that look like? And the person I was talking to said, I don't know, would that be maybe like Berlusconi in Italy? And again, I don't really know him well at all, but what has the impression that a kind of wacky sort of demagogic guy got elected, I think maybe twice even in Italy, but he kind of did his thing and pranced around and, you know, whatever as president and the system, for better or worse, it's Italy, but I mean, you know, kind of chugged along and it didn't really change, you know, people weren't, it wasn't Berlusconiism, you know? I mean, Trump could have been a little bit that way, I think. But it's the rationalization and the enabling that's in a way the more potent story, the more story, I'd almost say, than the fact that by accident we elected, you know, our 45th president is not someone who's fit for office. That's not a little thing, but by itself, it needn't have been as decisive as it may well have been for the country, for the conservative movement, for the Republican Party. But you were early on this, and I love when you get attacked. Didn't this happen kind of recently for, you know, Charlie, no one's willing to acknowledge their mistakes. It's like you wrote a whole book saying that we were not as aware.
Oh, yeah, that was Carlos Lozado, and he, in the who's written a book about all of this, and he keeps arguing that if it was not for Trump, nobody would have ever asked these questions. Well, yeah, some of us did. You know, I agree with you completely on all of this. You know, Donald Trump is exactly who we said he was going to be. I don't know how anyone thought that he was going to be different than all of this. So, you know, he is being himself. It is this transformation of the rest of the Republican Party, you know, their willingness to go along with it. And I could understand the transactional nature of some of it, where they would say, okay, we'll deal with you so we get the tax cuts. But it has been the support of everything else, the willingness to step out. You know, it's one thing for, say, a Ron Johnson to say, I want to cut taxes. Okay, we get that. That's what, you know, you run on. But do you have to then be, you know, become a fluffer? Do you have to become somebody who is, you know, carrying his water, you know, even at his absolute worst? And there's one other point that you have made, you know, many times. It's also possible to say, it is possible, and just people bear with me here, that okay, Trump was not as bad if you're a conservative. Trump actually governed as a conservative, gave me a lot of things that I actually like. I like the judges, I like the regulation, I like the taxes and everything. But even though I can defend many of those things, I am not willing to give him another 4 years. So it's one thing to defend him against all of his critics. It's another thing to say, yes, I want to extend this for another half decade. And that's kind of breathtaking when you think about it, because there's no illusions about who he is, how he governs, or what an absolute catastrophe a second term would be. And yet watching conservatives and Republicans being, yeah, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with giving him the kind of power giving this man, you know, the power to control the FBI, you know, fire the FBI director and control the intelligence agencies and have access to the nuclear button for another 48 months.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you were, and you are, and I am too, but if one were really pro-life conservative, extremely concerned about the courts, I think exaggerating how much good or harm the courts can do, but let's just leave that aside. I think that's just the most fundamental thing, and maybe one or two other issues like that. You know, I respect that. You support all the one would have been supported those judicial nominees. One would be very pleased by that. One would give Trump more credit than I would give him in the whole scheme of things for that. Fine. But then, you know what? Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed. She was sworn in. She's on the court. She's not going anywhere. Then you could say, I would think, okay, you know what? I don't regret supporting him in 2016. I don't regret having stayed in support of him for quite a long time here, because we got a lot that I truly, truly, truly care about. But I totally agree with you. To then not be willing to say another 4 years really is unacceptable. I mean, that is striking. Now, I would say personally, I've now talked to two people. I don't think this is a big sliver of the population. These are the people who, you know, in intellectual conservative circles in Washington and New York and so forth, who were sort of on the bubble about voting for him again. They're deeply torn for various reasons, probably weren't going to vote for him, maybe couldn't vote for Biden. And I would say for them, the actual confirmation of Justice Barrett has freed them up not to vote for him. They don't feel much pressure now. They feel like, you know what? I took a lot of grief from people like me and Charlie, the two of us. My friend said, you know, for these last 4 years, I feel like it was worth it. You don't? Fine. That's the difference. But I don't have to vote for him. I don't know if that has any resonance in the, you know, in the population as a whole. It's a pretty complicated calculation. Pretty much you have to be kind of a conservative movement, you know, insider probably to think that way. But it was an interesting conversation.
Well, I do wonder just how much the exhaustion factor, and I've said this before, I just, the people, if you go into the voting booth, if people don't do that anymore, but think, do I really want to listen to this guy for another 4 years? Do I want to have to defend this for another 4 years? Can I take this for another 4 years? I just think that's going to be a factor. By the way, while you and I are speaking, the Cook report just moved Texas's 38 electoral votes from lean Republican to toss up.
Wow! Interesting.
Because they're pretty solid people. So this is this is Amy Walter and company. And again, I don't think that it's going to happen. I would not, you know, bet my life on it. You know what? Texas is going to turn is going to turn blue at some point. The question is whether it's this year or whether it's going to be next year or whether it's going to be the year after that. And that's something that Republicans are going to have to, you know, come to grips with. Okay, so I addressed this question yesterday, and we're sort of on the same theme here. You know, Ben Shapiro was very, very solidly Never Trump back in, you know, back in 2016. And he's decided, he's got a formula that he has in his head, which is that, yes, you know, Trump is a Vesuvius of mendacity. He's a man of very, very low character. But the damage that he has done by being a man of low character has already been done. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether you vote for him or again, because all the damage has already been done. That is the new normal. I just think that that is so profoundly wrong that every lesson of history tells you that it can get worse. And with Donald Trump, there is no bottom. So in terms of rationalization, that just strikes me as the weirdest, because I think a second term would be exponentially even worse than the first term. And I think we're already seeing that. He's not pretending to have an agenda. He's not pretending to have an answer for deficit and debt, for, you know, turning the economy around. In terms of immigration, more cruelty, you know, in terms of healthcare, he obviously has no policy whatsoever. He's going to fire the defense secretary. He's probably going to fire the FBI director. And now he's figured out that maybe he can use the Department of Justice as his own personal plaything. So this whole notion that it can't get worse strikes me as horribly naive.
Yeah, I totally agree. For me, that was always, you said this earlier, the kind of the breaking point with people who, you know, were, it's one thing to have approved of much that he had, some of what, or what he had done, or much of what he had done, but to then say a second term, no problem, give it to him, was always for me the kind of breaking point that I just couldn't stomach or couldn't, you know, even understand in a certain way. I thought they just, they are now just in sort of being team players, tribalists, and rationalizers and enablers. But now Trump is publicly basically said he's going to fire the FBI director and the press secretary. I mean, now you really are getting, I mean, he's over, a lot of the guardrails have gone down. We're not talking Jim Mattis and even Don McGahn or Jeff Sessions even anymore. We're talking another level of kind of cooperation and capitulation, really, to the notion that they just work for Trump. They don't work for the U.S. government. They don't have loyalty to the laws and the Constitution as well as to the president. But we'll be at another stage in 3-6 months if he gets reelected. And then 4 years and embolden Trump, the Republican Party, there'll be no opposition because he would be so dominant, of course. The Republicans would have held the Senate, I suppose, if Trump's reelected. And they'll just be, you know, they'll feel they tied themselves to him and they were vindicated. That's how they'll think about it. So I just can't, yeah, it's one thing to be, you know, pro-Trump, I guess, and then you're just pro-Trump. It's another thing to have been anti-Trump, to see how bad he is in some ways. They used to see how bad he is in some ways. And then sort of just ignore what's happening in front of one's eyes, including in the COVID thing. I mean, he's literally telling us that if he's reelected, we're just on to herd immunity and nothing. I mean, maybe CDC will be allowed to put out occasional reports telling people they should wear masks. You know, obviously, the vaccine hunt will continue, hopefully, and hopefully successfully. But basically, the notion that we'll get serious about testing so that we could reopen more schools and all that, the notion of any federal plan, all that just collapses. The notion, I would say, incidentally, protecting people's pre-existing conditions, which he seems to think he can do by saying it, collapses. I mean, just the degree to which we're in a total meltdown then after November 3rd, I don't see how people can then say, but, you know, the second term would be okay.
Yeah. But so one last point. You and I had a shared experience the other day. We were, you know, scheduled to be on an MSNBC program, and we were, at least for a portion of it, we were preempted by former President Obama's speech. And so you got to sit and listen to President Obama's speech. So I was listening to that, and I was thinking, you know, I don't remember Obama being this funny before. Yeah. Now, maybe that's because, you know, we spent the Obama years on the other side. But then I see the New York Times basically saying that the guy's having an absolute blast, just dragging and ripping Trump. But that was a surprisingly entertaining but really effective speech. And if I'm Joe Biden, I'm letting Barack Obama go out and give that speech as many times as possible. And I never want to follow that speech.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's good. I saw him for a minute. I don't watch much TV, really, but I, for whatever reason, it was Susan Zerzeron. I think we were having sandwiches for lunch. And Obama spoke at midday yesterday in Orlando.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have to see a little bit of that. Maybe you were.
I watched that.
Mostly one sees these speeches when one's on, and then there's, of course, you know, that you have to wait. And so you watch them as you're sitting at your desk looking at your screen anyway, and with MSNBC or CNN on or whatever. And I think Fox even carried that speech. And it was effective. And it looks like he feels a little liberated, and not quite the way when you're president that you have to be. That was a different era, of course. When you're president, you have to be measured in your words, a little careful.
Right, right.
He wasn't always, but he was most of the time. But now he can be a little more free-flowing. But it was effective. We both sat there watching it for a few minutes and thought, you know, this is so, I don't know how much difference it makes. Surrogates, again, usually overrated. Maybe they turn out a few people. But, you know, Orlando is a Democratic area. And if he can show up there and remind people they have to vote in a close, what could be a very close state like Florida, you know, that makes a difference. So, again, it's another advantage the Democrats have. They have good surrogates. Trump, who does Trump have campaigning for him?
Well, now that's interesting because Joe Biden has the best possible surrogate from his point of view with Barack Obama. Who is the best surrogate for Donald Trump? And the answer is what? Don Jr.? Eric?
And I would say, incidentally, I mean, I haven't really looked into this, so I'll put this out as a question, not a statement. So there are maybe in the swing states, let me just put it this way. There are elected Republicans, obviously. There's Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. There's someone like Scott Walker, who was elected three times until 2018. There's in Pennsylvania, there's Pat Toomey. So Pennsylvania is probably the closest to those three upper Midwestern states. Has Pat Toomey done an event for Donald Trump? Is he actually bothering to tell anyone who's voted for him? He's been on the ballot, statewide two or three times in Pennsylvania and got a lot of votes. To vote for Trump. And even in Florida, where I think Scott's been a little more outspoken for Trump, Rubio, DeSantis, but I wouldn't say you get the sense that they're stumping feverishly around the state. I think they're showing up when Trump shows up and they're doing their duty, so to speak, as they see it. So it is kind of interesting how, even the they're all shamefully accommodating of Trump, and I don't give them any credit for being a little lazy and campaigning for him. But it is interesting that they don't want to simply be out there, you know, hammering away for him and going to any terrific trouble, it doesn't seem.
Yeah, the only ones that you hear from are the Republican senators who really don't think they have a choice, you know, the Kelly Lefflers of the world or the Martha McSallys, who are basically setting themselves on fire to prove their Trumpiness. And by the way, just sort of parenthetically, because Jim Swift and I were talking about this before we started the podcast, it's really interesting to me to watch in some of these states that we're now thinking of as possible bubble states, you know, flipping from red to blue, that one of the through lines has been the way that the Republican Party has made itself much more Trumpy and much more sort of fever swampy. We saw it in Arizona, which is about to flip blue. We're seeing it in Georgia, where there's this fight to be, you know, who can embrace QAnon more closely. In Texas, they went and they got Alan West, who is, you know, kind of a out there, you know, figure from a former congressman who's now their chairman. These things are repelling people. Even here in Wisconsin, whatever you might think of Scott Walker was, I think, kind of a guardrail to the crazies in the Republican Party. And with his departure, you're seeing a lot of really bizarre stuff. It's hard for me to imagine that if Scott Walker was still the governor, that you would have the Republican Party in Waukesha County having a dinner at which Michelle Malkin is the keynote speaker and leads a standing ovation for Kyle Rittenhouse's mom, Kyle Rittenhouse being the 17-year-old that killed two people in Kenosha. That wouldn't be happening. But since it is happening, I think this is one of the things that suburban voters, college-educated white voters, are looking at this going, you know, if this is what the Republican Party is, I'm out, I'm gone. So the Republican Party in these key states, by moving, Virginia would be another example, you know, as they become crazier, they are repelling more and more voters. And I think that's going to be something that's going to become more and more obvious when we see the results of this election.
And I suppose we can close on this and then get back to what we're talking about. How much does that persist going forward? I think it could persist going forward. So, and a lot will depend on Biden. I mean, that's the other great thing. We're all having these debates on future of the Republican Party and conservatism, which makes sense for us to have. But a lot depends on how Biden governs, obviously. And is he viewed as successful? Is he reasonably moderate? Does it look like a reasonable governing party? I'd say in Virginia, I'm struck where, you know, that was, this was a Republican state in terms of mm-hmm. the governors we usually elected and senators for that matter, until 10, 15 years ago. It started to slide Democratic and Obama carried it and stuff. But one reason why it's become solidly Democratic is, and I say this as a conservative who doesn't agree with all the policies, you know, it's a pretty well-governed state. And the fact that we've had Democratic governors since what now, McAuliffe and now Northam, since 2013, whatever Northam's personal problems with the black race mm-hmm. and all that, they're not governing like crazy people. Businesses are not fleeing Virginia. You know, they're not raising taxes right and left. They're, you know, there are things they're doing that are, you know, bad, and I wish they wouldn't do it. I would probably be happier if there were one Republican House in the state legislature left to check them, but there's not because of the whole party's gone so insanely Trumpy, incidentally. But I mean, to the degree that Biden, let's say, governs, if I can put it this way, like a Terry McAuliffe in Virginia and not like a far left, you know, Democrat, it will make it easier for people having deserted a Trumpy Republican Party once to decide, A, it still looks, it's still, that's the party, you know, mm-hmm. and B, I can just desert it next time. So that's where, again, the size of the defeat and the reaction to the defeat and whether people, that's why it's not enough, I think, though, to just quietly move on and sort of pretend that didn't happen. People need to say to reassure the voters you're talking about, yeah, that was, some of that was a mistake. We're not going in that direction in the future.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, this is going to leave an indelible mark for a very long time. And I know a lot of Republicans are going to want to move into the, hey, that didn't happen really fast. But I don't think it's going to work. Bill Kristol, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
I enjoyed the discussion, Charlie, as always.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again. There are, believe it or not, just 6 days to go.